System on RadioArea.com.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and this podcast is going to be entitled The Hidden History of Christian Britain. And I'm basically going to expand upon the subjects that I was talking about in my recent speech at the Welsh Forum. When I was there, I actually forgot all my ad-libs where I didn't write everything down. So what I'm going to do here is go over what I went through in that talk and also explain I'm basically going to expand upon some of the subjects that I brought up. So it will be similar to that talk, but there'll be a lot more information included in it as well. Now I'm going to start with a quote from Taliesin the Bard from the 6th century. Now Taliesin, they believe, could possibly have been who the figure of Merlin was actually based upon. They claim that he was in Arthur's court. And he was writing this after the Druids had become Christians, because the Celtic people, the British people, were all Christian before the Anglo-Saxons invaded. And what we're told today is that Christianity didn't really come to Britain until Augustine in the 6th century. And then they'll tell you that these kings gradually became Christian. But they were all the Anglo-Saxon kings. Before that, the country was British, and the British people, the Anglo-Saxons, pushed into Wales. They are now the Welsh people. But they'd all been Christian since the first century, which we're going to be talking about in this podcast. But back to this quote here from Taliesin the Bard, and this is what he said. Christ the Word from the beginning was in the beginning our teacher, and we never lost his teachings. Christianity was a new thing in Asia, but there never was a time when the Druids of Britain held not to its doctrines. So what we're going to do is look at this quote and see how it could be true. Now, there was no conflict between the Druids and the Christians. Both of these faiths were outlawed by Rome. So Britain was a sanctuary for Christians, and it was a sanctuary for Druids. And the thing that the Druids and the Christians had in common, or one thing among many, was that neither of them would bow to the pagan idols of Rome. And there's never actually been found any idols in Britain apart from Roman ones. This is another misconception that people have. They think that before we became Christian, we were worshipping idols. Some of the Saxons, they believe that some of the Saxons may have had idols of Woden or Odin. But personally, I'm not sure how true that is. I know that in Britain, we never found any. So the Britons, the early Britons, they were not idol worshippers. The Druids and the Christians, they got on well together. There were no martyred Christians from this time. The Druids weren't putting them to death. In fact, there were no martyred Christians in Britain until the Diocletian persecution, which is in the 2nd century. At around 150 and 170 AD, there was a king called Lucius, and he pronounced the whole nation Christian. Now, we know this because we have a stone in St. Peter on Cornhill, a church in London, which records this. We know this because there are various quotes that say that Britain was Christian by this time, and it was also confirmed at various church councils over the last 1,000 years. So the Catholic Church did admit this. And they actually produced a letter, supposedly from King Lucius to Pope Eleutherius, asking him about the law and about how he could apply Christian law to the new Christian nation of Britain. But at this time, I mean, the Britons were rebelling against Rome all the time. And when Augustine came here in the 6th century, he met up with the Celtic Church. And the Celtic Church said, well, you know, Rome has been our enemy for all this time. We've been Christian all this time, while Rome has been pagan. Why should we pay you any more respect than we would to any other Christian? So that shows you the sort of attitude that the Britons had to the Romans. So King Lucius would not have been asking the Pope for permission to become Christian. King Lucius was already a Christian because Christianity had actually already been in Britain for well over a century by that time. And we know this because, again, we have records that Joseph of Arimathea travelled straight to Britain after the crucifixion between 35 and 38 AD. We also have records of Aristobulus and other apostles coming over to Britain. Again, this is because they had sanctuary in Britain. While they were being persecuted in Rome and in Jerusalem, they knew that in Britain, Christianity was legal. So they could come here and they knew that they would be safe. Also, when they came here, they knew that they would be able to make use of the Druidic universities that we had here. We had over we had 40 separate universities based around the cathedral cities that we have now. And they were we had arch flamens there, basically. And when Lucius pronounced the whole nation Christian, they became archbishops, and the flamens actually became bishops. Now, we know that when he pronounced the whole nation Christian, he had the permission of everyone, because according to the law, the ancient British laws, the ancient usages of the country, the only way you could actually change the religion of the country was by unanimous vote. So you had to have had a unanimous vote to change the nation from following Druidry to calling themselves Christian. So it wasn't like this was against the people's will, and it certainly wasn't against the Druids' will, because the Druids became the archbishops. So if we look back further before this time, let's look at these records of Joseph of Arimathea. Now, apparently he travelled to France. He also had Lazarus with him and a few others. And then from France, he came to England, supposedly to Cornwall. We have lots of legends and folklore about Joseph of Arimathea being in Cornwall and him being a tin trader. We have other records saying that he was a noblesse de curio. He was part of the Sanhedrin, I believe, and he was also part of very important to do with Romans. He was their tin trader. He would come to Britain to pick the tin up from St. Michael's Mount. And we also have records of Britain being a famous tin exporter for 1,000 years before that time, which we're going to get into later on in the podcast. So after the crucifixion, Joseph of Arimathea makes his way to Britain. He knows Britain already. I mean, we have legends of him actually bringing Jesus as a boy to Britain. And we have these strange crosses that we find in Cornwall that are of a young boy, basically. And they say that this was the young Jesus, that Joseph brought him over to Britain. So when he comes to Britain, he's granted 12 hides of land by King Caradoc, who is also known as King Caractacus. Now, some people say that this land was in Glastonbury, because we have records of that. And there are others that say that this land was actually in South Wales, in Llandaff, which is near, we have Llandaff Cathedral in Cardiff. And we do have records of somebody here called Clyd, I think his name is, that they believe could have actually been Joseph of Arimathea. Because King Caradoc was the king of South Wales. He was a Silurian king. So it would have been a bit strange if he gave him land in Glastonbury. But we do have records of Joseph of Arimathea being in Britain, and possibly the Norman kings tried to make it look like it was actually in Glastonbury rather than in South Wales, because we have places that are named after him in South Wales as well. And he supposedly had a pupil who was one of the other king's daughters, one of the princesses. It may have been Iergain, but I couldn't be certain on that. Anyway, so Joseph of Arimathea comes to Britain straight after the crucifixion, and there's no animosity between him and the Druids. And he's given this land by King Caradoc. And King Caradoc was fighting against the Romans, and he would later actually be captured by the Romans, and he was sold out by Cartus Mandua of the Brigantes. He was actually sold out by a female. And he gets taken to Rome in chains, and he makes a famous speech appealing to the humanity of Rome. And he says, Rome is famous for being fierce and deadly in battle, and for running a huge empire, and absolutely merciless. And wouldn't it be great if Rome actually went down in history as Rome the Merciful, just this once? And Caesar was so impressed with the speech that Caradoc gave to him that he accepted his plea for mercy. He gave him clemency, and he said, "Okay, we'll have peace, but you'll have to stay in Rome under house arrest." And I believe his father had to stay there as well, Bran, who is another famous king. Now, we don't know whether King Caradoc actually was already a Christian at this time, whether he'd been converted by Joseph of Arimathea, or whether he became a Christian when he was actually in Rome. But where he lived, where he was under house arrest, was called the Palatium Britannicum, which is obviously the palace of the Britons. And this was the first British church in Rome, was the Palatium Britannicum. It would later be known as the Hospitium Apostolorum, because the apostle stayed there. And then after that, it was named St. Pudentiana, which is named after Caradoc's great-granddaughter, whose father, Pudens, is mentioned in St. Paul's letters. This is supposedly the place where St. Paul actually stayed, is the Palatium Britannicum. And the first bishop of the British church in Rome was made there, and that was Linus. And this is confirmed by Irenaeus in the 2nd century and others. Linus is in all these lists, and he was the son or brother of Claudia Britannica, the daughter of Caradoc. So we can see that Britain had a very important role to play in early Christianity. The British nation was made Christian in 150, 170 AD, and the first actual church in Rome was the British church in the home of the British king. So we know that Britain had Christians right from the start. But what about the Druids before them? How could they have been Christian before Christ? What is Taliesin the Bard talking about? How could that possibly be? Well, we're told that the Druids didn't actually write anything down, but we do know that they did. And there are thousands of manuscripts written by the Druids that are lying in the Bodleian Library unpublished. We also, well, they're written in Welsh, basically, so we can read them. It's just that they're not translated into English. And we also have writings from Caesar and Strabo and others. And when Caesar was writing, he was writing from a negative viewpoint. It was negative propaganda that he was writing against the Druids. And it's from Caesar that we get this idea that the Druids practiced human sacrifice. But we've never, ever found any evidence of human sacrifice in Britain. And Caesar talks about wickerwork structures with human beings inside that the Druids would set fire to. And I think it's far more likely that that was Caesar's troops setting fire to the wickerwork houses that the ancient Britons used to live in. And another thing that a lot of people don't realise about Rome when Rome came into Britain, we'd actually defeated Rome twice before we came to this peace treaty with Caradoc. You know, I mean, you don't have savages defeating the might of Imperial Rome. We had to have had a high stage of civilization, and we had to have a strong military to defeat Rome twice. Now, Caesar tells us that we had chariots with scythes coming out from the wheels. Now, if we had chariots, we had to have roads. And this is another lie that we're told. We're told all the straight roads in Britain were built by the Romans. Yet if they were built by the Romans, how come we were riding around in chariots on them when Caesar first got here? And Caesar was really surprised by these chariots as well, because they'd fallen out of use on the mainland. These chariots actually go all the way back to the ancient Mediterranean civilizations, which we're going to look at later on in this podcast. We also had laws, the laws of Malmutius. And the laws of Malmutius were almost 1,000 years before Alfred the Great. And yet Alfred the Great incorporated these laws, these Malmutine laws, into his common law when he wrote that down. When Caesar got here, we already had a walled city of London for protection. We'd had a long line of kings. We'd had 1,000 years worth of kings by the time that Caesar actually got here. As I say, we had 40 universities. There could have been anything up to 60,000 students being educated at them at any one time. And the cream of the Northern Europe nobility would be educated here in these universities that we had. Now, there's a recent dig in Peterborough, which is 3,000 years old, which shows that we had a high standard of living at that time. And they've also just recently released aerial pictures of the south coast of England. And what it shows is that Britain in that time, 3,000 years ago, was at the same standards as Greek, Rome, and Egypt. We had suburbs, we had agricultural areas, we had roads linking it up to bring the produce into the cities for the people to live on. And this is all borne out by our most ancient chronicles, which we're going to get to in a bit. So these Druids weren't savages, and the British people weren't savages. And from looking at what the Druids actually did write down, I mean, we've also got the triads. We've got these Welsh triads, which are composed from the earliest genealogical records and the earliest records that we have of the Britons. And from that, we can gather that the Druids' motto was the truth against the world, which is a very Christian motto to have. And we find out from Caesar that the Druids believed in life after death, which was different to a lot of beliefs at that time. And he actually says that the reason why the British people were so fierce in battle is because they believed in life after death. Like, believing in life after death was superior to a lot of the beliefs at that time, possibly superior even to some of the beliefs that the early Hebrews had. They believed in animal sacrifice for sins, again, which is exactly the same as the priesthood of the Old Testament. The Old Testament was all about animal sacrifice for sins. The Druids believed in a triune God, past, present, and future. And they actually called their triune God. It had three names, Taram, Bel, and Yisu. And the British people are unique in the world at not actually changing the name of their God once they became Christian. Of course, Yisu is Jesus. And this idea of the three gods in one that people claim, or the church likes to claim, that it was entirely original, this thought of the Trinity. Yet the Druids themselves had a Trinity before they accepted Christianity. So it may well be that the origin of the Trinity, the actual thought of that, goes back to these Druids. Now, Procopius of Caesarea, writing in 530 AD, he confirms this, and this is a quote from him. He says, Jesus, Taran, Bel, one only God. All Druids acknowledge one Lord God alone. So we weren't worshipping all these different gods. We had one God, but he may have had different faces, different attributes to him. That was what it was, and the different names were for the different attributes, because it was representing the past, the present, and the future. The priesthood, the Druidic priesthood, was hereditary. Again, that's exactly the same as the priesthood in the Old Testament. And you had to show that for the past 10 generations, you had been a true-born nobleman in order to actually become a Druid. The Druids had reverence for oak trees. And people often don't realise this, but Abraham in the Old Testament, he had a reverence for oak trees as well. The Druids wore white linen, the same as in the Old Testament. Now, our ancient law of sanctuary in the church, which is if you can get to a church, then you're safe and the police can't come in there to get you out. That actually goes back to our stone circles and our mounds. And if you could get to the stone circle, then nobody could harm you in there. You would be safe in there. And it was the same with the mounds. We've also got these mounds in Britain. And I believe that in the so-called Sermon on the Mount in the New Testament, that would have been the Sermon on the Mound, because the people would gather at these mounds to hold court and decide on what they were going to do about things. You know, public policy would be decided at these mounds or in these circles. The Druids themselves were not expected to bear arms and fight. Again, that's the same as in the Old Testament. The Druids were paid a certain retainer from the people so that they could study, so they could devote themselves to study, basically. Because the studying that they did, I mean, it would take eight to 12 years to get the degrees in Druidry. You had three different types, the bards, the ovates, and the Druids. And it took a lot of studying, and also studying in medicine, astrology, and the stars, agriculture, all these things that they would study. So, of course, if you're going to be doing that, you have to have your food paid for, your lodging paid for. So the Druids were covered for that. And again, in the Old Testament, the Levites given a tithe so that they can study and do all the things that priests are supposed to do. So we can see that there are similar customs and ideas in Druidry to Christianity, and also before that to the patriarchal priesthoods from the Old Testament. So what do the monuments that they left behind tell us? Do they have a biblical link? Well, they do have a biblical link, and most people are completely unaware of this. And what I mean by monuments are the stone circles, the menhirs, the dolmens, and the cairns. And some of these structures are just absolutely amazing. You've got three large stones set up on end in a triangle with a huge capstone on the top. I mean, weighing tons, these stones are, 2 or 3 tons for each stone. Just resting on this huge capstone, just resting on a corner of one of these uprights. And they're still stood there, 3,000-4,000 years later. I don't think anything that we build today is likely to still be there in 3,000-4,000 years' time. We also have huge, great solitary standing stones that are just standing in the middle of nowhere, 3 meters high, 6 to 8 meters wide. And they're just standing there in the middle of Britain. We actually have more of these megaliths in Britain than anywhere else in the world. And Stonehenge is obviously the most famous one. That was fairly recently built. Stonehenge itself was built to the same unit of measurement as the Great Pyramid of Egypt, which shows you that this civilization that they had, they were all linked up together because they were using the same unit of measurement. And there was also another unit of measurement that they used, and this guy, Professor Tom, he went around and measured all these stones, and he discovered what he called the megalithic yard and the megalithic inch. And he basically proved that the people that were building these structures, they all had communication between them, and they were all building to the same unit of measurement. Now, these stone structures, we know that no metal tools were ever used upon them. And this is despite them being erected during the Bronze and the Iron Ages. So you would have thought they would have carved things into them or used these metal tools, but they didn't. And this is exactly as commanded in the Old Testament more than once. More than one time it says, when you build these stone structures, you must not use iron tools upon them. Now, I'm not going to bore you by reading lots of different verses out from the Bible, but there are 13 separate verses in different books referring to these megaliths. And that is the oldest written references to these structures in the world. And they're commanding the Israelites to erect them wherever they went, as boundary stones, way markers, for instruction, as a witness. And we find them all over the world, wherever the white man has been. There are some particularly spectacular ones in Korea. There are loads in Palestine, obviously, and also in Persia and India. But as I say, they're mainly in Britain. And I'll read you one verse from Deuteronomy chapter 27. And this is actually more than one verse. It's verses 1 to 5. But I've truncated it slightly so that you've just got the important stuff in it. And Moses, with the elders of Israel, commanded the people, saying, "Thou shalt set thee up great stones, and plaster them with plaster. And thou shalt write upon them all the words of this law, when thou art passed over, that thou mayest go in unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Therefore it shall be, when ye be gone over Jordan, that ye shall set up these stones, which I command you this day in Mount Ebal, and thou shalt plaster them with plaster, and there shalt thou build an altar unto the Lord thy God, an altar of stones. Thou shalt not lift up any iron tool upon them." So basically what we've got there is we've got a great standing stone plastered with the words of the law on it. We've got other stones, set up great stones so that people can see them. And we've also got an altar being built with no iron tool being used upon it. Now, when we see these great standing stones just standing there on their own in the countryside of Britain, and you think, well, what's that doing there? What was the point of that? Well, I would suggest that originally that would have had plaster upon it and the words of the law written on there. And the law didn't used to be a complicated thing. It was something that everybody had to know. It had to be easy to remember. And it would have been able to be put just on one of these stones. And if anybody broke it, you could point to it and say, well, look, you know, you've got no excuse for saying you didn't know the law. Everyone can see it there. It's all on these stones. Now, one of the other structures that are mentioned in the Old Testament, besides these great big standing stones, we also have stones that are put up as a witness for treaties that are being made. There's a stone circle that's put up as a remembrance of an event. There's all sorts of reasons for them actually putting these stones up there. But one of the things that's actually mentioned in the Old Testament that people aren't really aware of is it tells us that Abraham was laid to rest in a cave in a field. Now, when you think about it, a field is flat. You are not likely to have a cave in a field. The only way you are going to get a cave in a field is if you build the cave yourself. And of course, we do have these caves in fields all over Britain. It's obviously a barrow, like West Kennet Long Barrow, or the one in Newgrange in Ireland. I mean, some of these barrows, they're still covered over with earth, and other ones, the earth has been taken away, and you can see these the structure that's left there behind. Again, which is like these dolmens. Some of these dolmens were originally these barrows. But Abraham was evidently laid to rest in one of these huge great barrows out there in Palestine. So we can see that there's quite a few links here that are becoming apparent between the ancient Druids, the ancient Britons, and the people of the Old Testament. Another thing that we learn from the Druids that they used to do with these stones is that they used to anoint them with rose oil. And this is exactly the same as Jacob Israel did with his Bethel stone. People probably remember this. In the Old Testament, Jacob Israel goes to sleep with a stone for a pillow. And during his sleep, he sees a ladder and there are angels ascending and descending upon this ladder. It's called Jacob's ladder. And when he gets up in the morning, he anoints the stone with oil and takes it with him. And that stone, which was called the Bethel stone, oh, he also builds an altar there as well, I think, if I remember rightly. But that stone was called the Bethel stone. And apparently that is the stone that's underneath the queen's throne. All the high kings of Tara were crowned upon it. And then it was brought to Scotland. The kings of Scotland were crowned upon it. And then it was brought to England, I think it was by Edmund I. He brought it back from Scotland to England, and all the English kings have been crowned on it ever since. And the legends tell us that this stone was brought into Ireland by Olam Fodler. And that's the Irish name for him. But his other name was Jeremiah. And apparently he went to Ireland after the fall of Jerusalem. He moved into Ireland with his scribe, Baruch the scribe, and he brought this stone with him. And the stone is called the Stone of Scone. And they've actually tested this stone, this rock that's under the Queen's throne. And it's made of exactly the same type of sandstone that you find in Palestine. So, you know, the likelihood is that this story is true. There's been a lot of research done on this. And they all claim that it was Jeremiah that came over to Ireland. And apparently he brought over two daughters of the last king of Jerusalem with him. And these queens, these princesses rather, married into the royal line that was already in Ireland. That's where the Queen of England today can trace her history back to King David. That's where it goes through. It's through these princesses that Jeremiah brought with him into Ireland. But that's not the only thing that links the royal family to the people of Israel, as we'll find out later on. There's a link previous to Jeremiah bringing the princesses over to Ireland. So, we can see that we have a link between the priesthoods, the customs, and the monuments between the ancient Druids and the people of the Old Testament. But are there any specific written records of us both being the same people? Well, there are, and in some most surprising places. But first off, we're going to have a look at an unconditional promise that was made to Abraham. Now, Abraham was white. He was not a Jew by any definition of the word. He was not a Jew by being Judean. Judea didn't exist. He was not a Jew through being descended from Judah. Judah didn't exist. and he was not a Jew by the Jewish religion, because the Jewish religion didn't exist at this time. Jacob Israel had not even been born. Isaac had not even been born. But Abraham, who left where he was when he was told to by God, and was told that he would have his wife would have a child, Sarah would have a child at a very late age. His wife was supposed to be very beautiful and very white. The Dead Sea Scrolls tell us that she was beautiful and white. Abraham himself, he was very, very, very picky about who his sons married. I mean, marrying within your caste was extremely important to him. The idea that Abraham would ever have gone off with someone that was non-white, or Isaac or Jacob Israel, is just is unthinkable. It was a really important thing to them to make sure that their descendants married the right people. So Abraham was obviously white. He could not have been anything else. So the descriptions of all his descendants tell us that they were fair, ruddy of face, blue of eye. So Abraham was white. And anyway, God makes a covenant with Abraham. Now, this is a completely unconditional covenant. He doesn't say, oh, if you obey me, I'll do this for you. He just makes this covenant with him, this promise. And the promise is that many nations would come from Abraham's loins, and they would number as many as the sand of the sea and the stars of the heavens. And he also makes other prophecies and promises to him. He tells him that these nations that would come from his loins, they would have a world empire. They would have a commonwealth. He tells them that they would have kings and princes that would come from these nations. They would possess the gates of their enemies. They would move to the north, the south, the east, and the west, all the points of the compass. And they would colonize the desolate places. They would have great agricultural and mineral wealth. They'd be invincible and undefeatable. But they would have a new name and a new language. They would have control of the seas. They would be the custodians of the scriptures, which is the Bible. But they would lose all trace of their lineage. They would forget who they were. Now, I don't know about you, but all those promises and prophecies, they don't sound like they're talking about the Jews to me. They sound like they're talking about white people, and only white people. They're not applicable to anyone else. And don't forget, this covenant was unconditional. And this promise was passed on to Isaac, Abraham's son. And then that was passed on to Jacob Israel. And Jacob Israel had 12 sons, and the promises continued through them. Now Judah was one of these 12 sons, and he was the one that was given kingship. He was the one that was told that all the kings and princes would come from him. And he had twin sons through Tamar, and Tamar was his only lawful wife. And the first of these twin sons to put his hand out had a red cord tied around it, as he was the firstborn. He would receive the birthright and the blessings that all accrue to the firstborn. Now his name was Zarah, and his twin was Phares. Phares, we read about in the Bible, he started the Davidic line of kings, which stayed in the Near and the Middle East. And Zarah, and this isn't in the Bible, but we're going to see where later on, Zarah started all the kingly lines of Europe through his sons Darda and Chalcol. And Darda and Chalcol are likened in wisdom to Solomon in the Bible. So they're obviously very, very capable people. Now, Zarah and his family, we read about while the Israelites are in captivity in Egypt, and they are counted in a census. But that's it. We never hear of them again. This hugely important family that we've just been told all about the birth, I mean, it's the only birth we're actually told about in detail in the Bible, this hugely important family disappear entirely from the biblical record after that, while they're actually in Egypt. So what we have to do then is turn to the pagan histories. Now, the pagan histories tell us that the most distinguished foreigners in Egypt left with Danius and Cadmus, while the others went with Moses. So I would suggest that what's being told there is that the people under Zarah left Egypt, and the people under Phares stayed in Egypt, and they left with Moses. Now, Diodorus Siculus is telling us this, and he quotes Hecate. He's quoting Hecateus from the 6th century BC, but also Euripides tells us this, and Strabo as well. So we've got three witnesses there that are telling us that this is what happened. Distinguished foreigners left Egypt at the time of Moses. Then the records tell us that Calcol went to Ireland and Dada went to Troy, or their descendants basically went there. And just on the southern shores of Troy, we have the Dardanelles, which are named after Dada. And in Spain, we have Zaragoza, which is named after Zara. We're also told about this time that the tribe of Dan left. And we can see that the tribe of Dan left by looking at the censuses in the Old Testament. So the tribe of Dan left around about this time. They settled Greece and Argos. And then later on, in the Maccabees, we read about the Lacedaemonians, or the Spartans, sending an emissary to claim kinship with the tribe of Judah. And the tribe of Judah acknowledge it and say, yes, the Spartans, you are our kinsmen. And this is confirmed by Flavius Josephus. And Flavius Josephus claims that he actually saw the seal that the tribe that these Spartans had with them. And the seal was an eagle with a dragon in its claws. And this is the heraldry of the tribe of Dan. Every one of those 12 sons of Jacob Israel, they were all given their own emblem. They were given a blessing by Isaac, and Isaac gave each one of them a special emblem, which lies at the roots of our heraldry today. You think about the lion and the unicorn, the lion of Judah. The Jews have never, ever used it. Once they took over Palestine and they got their terrorist state of Israel, they made up this dodgy picture of a lion and said that this was the emblem of Israel. But they never actually used it before then, whereas the rampant lion has been used by the kingly houses of Europe for thousands of years. And this heraldry here, this eagle with a dragon in its claws, I mean, that is a really old symbol. And that is a symbol of the tribe of Dan. So the Spartans, they were the tribe of Dan. But we also read about the Danai of Greece, the Danann of Ireland, the Danes of Denmark. We also read the names of the Danube, the Dnieper, Dundee, Donegal, Dunonia, all these places with Dan as a prefix. And we're actually told in the Old Testament that the tribe of Dan were known for adding their name to everything. Everywhere they went, they would call it by the name of their tribe, by the name Dan, the prefix Dan. So that's the tribe of Dan. They were in Greece. But what about Troy? What happened in Troy with Dada that went to Troy and his descendants? Well, the descendant that we get there from Dada is Innes. Innes is the descendant of Dada. And when the Trojan War happens, Innes has to flee. He flees from Troy. That gets lost to history, only to be found again a century or so ago. And Innes founded Athens city-state. And he also marries the daughter of Latinus, King Latinus, and starts the Roman Empire. And their son was Brutus. And Brutus is where we come into the British history and the British chronicles and the start of the British nation and the name that we have for the British people. Now, Brutus can only mean like Brutus. British, the word British, descended from Brutus, can only mean people that look like Brutus. Cannot be used. The word British cannot be used to describe anyone that doesn't have white skin, because they don't look anything like Brutus. And the actual word Brutus itself, it has a dual meaning. As well as meaning Brutus the king, it also, the word for this covenant that was made with Abraham is Brit, and Ish is men. So British means covenant men, men of the covenant. And Brit in Welsh actually means numerous. And this covenant was that Abraham would have these numerous descendants. So in the actual name of King Brutus, we have a clue to this covenant that was made with, it was actually made with Abraham. Now, because his father, Innes, married the daughter of Latinus, that meant that there were Roman kings as well, and they were descended from the same people. But of course, the Romans actually killed their kings off. So they stopped having this royal line, which explains why they were so keen to marry into the British monarchy when they eventually came to Britain. And this is why we hear that Arthur was part Roman. King Constantine was part Roman. And this is because the Romans, the aristocracy of the Romans, would marry these British princesses, because then they would be able to have a claim to being Caesar. Then they would have a better, much better chance of running the Roman Empire if they could claim this pedigree going back through to Brutus. But where do we read about Brutus then? Well, we read about Brutus in a book called The Brute or The Chronicles of England. Now, this is compiled from all the earliest records. It's compiled from the Welsh records, the Anglo-Saxon records, and the Norman records. It was all collected together and translated into Old English about the 10th or the 11th century. But the stories that are contained within it are referred to by Gildas, by Bede, by the Romans themselves, by the Greeks themselves. Homer's Iliad and Odyssey talk about this character called Pirutus, who has the same adventures as Brutus does in the Chronicles of England. And there are lots of references to the British people being descended from Brutus in all these old histories. And Geoffrey of Monmouth, he used this history for his Historia Regum Britanniae. And what they actually did, they said that because we couldn't actually find any remains of Troy, this story must all be a myth. None of it can actually be true. But of course, they did actually find the ruins of Troy in the 19th century. And that confirmed that this story was true. It was talking about a real place. And of course, because in Troy they were known for their wheeled chariots, that's why, again, we still had these wheeled chariots when Caesar invaded us in the century before Christ. Anyway, get back to the story of Brutus. Innes and his wife have Brutus as a son. Brutus grows up and he accidentally kills Innes. Because of this, he has to leave. It's some kind of hunting accident that he has. So he leaves the country, moves to another one. I'm not sure if it was Spain or France, the next one that he went to. And when he gets there, he discovers his brother Trojans are all in captivity. They're all being enslaved. So he frees his brother Trojans. And then he has a vision of Diana. And Diana tells him that he should go to the White Isle. And when he gets there, he should found an empire that would last for all time. And of course, that empire is still lasting. That empire is the British people. We're still here. We may have had Saxons added to us. We may have had Normans added to us. But the original people, the Normans, the Saxons, and the Celts, were all originally one people. And Brutus was descended from them. So all of us will look like Brutus if we are still white. But Brutus gets to Britain. We have a stone where he landed at Totnes. We also have a stone in London that's named after him. And when he gets to Britain, he founds Nova Troy, which means New Troy. When Caesar gets here, he talks about this tribe that's living in the London area, and he calls them the Trinovantes, which of course is the people of New Troy. Trinovantes, the Trinovantes, the people of New Troy. New Troy itself later becomes known as London. This is the city that was built upon the Thames. When Brutus is trying to conquer the island, there are still people here. I mean, the Chronicles of England talk about there actually being people here. And they accept Brutus as their king. There's a fight in Cornwall. His friend Corineus, that Brutus has brought to Britain with him, he fights with this giant called Gogmagog on Plymouth Hoe, and he throws Gogmagog off the cliff. And that cliff face is still called Gogmagog's Leap to this day, because that's where Corineus threw him off this cliff. And Corineus, for doing this, is given that whole bit of land to himself. And that's where we get the name Cornwall from, is from this Corineus. And Brutus also had three sons, Camber, who started off the Welsh kings, Locrin, who was given northern England and part of Scotland, and Albanact, who ruled over the Pictish kings. And they built their civilization here in Britain that was based upon the one at Troy. And we find a lot of links with the original Trojan civilization, especially these mazes, which we actually call Troy Town, which are based upon a labyrinth. And of course, you remember the myth of the Minotaur and the labyrinth. That all goes back to these Trojan times. And we have these mazes that we used to cut into the turf which goes back to this history here at Troy. And again, as I say, the wheeled chariots that Caesar saw when he came here, that gives us another link to Troy. So Brutus is here. It starts off his empire. He's trading with the Phoenician Empire. And the Phoenician Empire, people don't realize, the Phoenician Empire, when it first started being written about, was at the time that Joshua controlled that area. Joshua pushed into northern Israel next to Sidon and Tyre. And the three city-states of Tyre, Sidon and Samaria, they would be the ones that actually ran the Phoenician Empire. And this is at the time when the Bible tells us that these people conquered the Assyrians. So they were powerful people at this time. This is at the time of Solomon and David. So they have their Phoenician Empire over there on the Middle East, on that strip of land, Israel. This is the other thing. People just assume that there's this small bit of land that was Canaan, and that the Israelites just stayed there. Well, what were they doing there? Sunbathing on the beach? And you've got a perfect point there for pushing boats off into the Mediterranean. So, of course, they were pushing off from the beach there, colonizing the world. And, of course, the actual word Hebrew is a Phoenician word for colonizer. And it comes from Eber, the word Eber, who was a descendant of Shem, one of the ancestors of Abraham. And that prefix Eber is in Hibernia, Iberia, and Hebrides. So this Phoenician Empire, they were so powerful, they actually managed to keep the Greeks and the Romans from actually getting out of the Mediterranean. And if these Greeks and Romans would try to follow them to see where they were getting their tin from, which was in Britain, they would scupper their ships. And then the Phoenician state would recompense and give compensation to that ship that had been scuppered, just to prevent the Greeks and Romans discovering where it was that they were getting their tin from. And of course, where they were actually getting their tin from was from Britain, from the Trojans that had colonized Britain. Now, the Phoenician alphabet is actually Paleo-Hebrew. Paleo-Hebrew, that's not spoken anymore. And the Old Testament itself was written down in Greek because Paleo-Hebrew had stopped being used by that time. And the Phoenician alphabet had stopped being used by that time. And when people say, oh yes, but our English alphabet could not possibly have come from Shem because it's not Semitic. Well, our alphabet comes from the Phoenician alphabet. The Latin alphabet comes from it. The Greek alphabet comes from it. The Phoenician alphabet, it was the original one. And that's where we get the word phonetic from. And the Phoenicians, this Phoenician empire, was the Israelite empire. And it was called the Phoenicians by the people writing about them, but by the Israelites, it was just called Israel because it was named after their tribes. And the Old Testament talks about this trading that they would do with the ships of Tarshish going to Spain. It talks about the Western Isles, which was obviously us in Britain. It talks about Solomon taxing all these, or taxes being paid to him from all these other countries. And this was at the height of the Phoenician Empire, you see. The Welsh language is probably the closest to this Paleo-Hebrew that we actually have today. And we can see that it has the same syntax and a lot of the similar phrases. The way that words are used are similar. And the Phoenician alphabet we find on stones in Scotland. We find stones in Scotland talking about one of these Phoenician kings coming over here. So we obviously had trade with these people. Cornish tin, that's been found in India, all over the world. The Cassiterides, the Tin Islands, were written about. And the Tin Islands was obviously Britain. So there's a lot of proof here, I think, that shows that there was this link with the Old Testament, and that we as the British people and as the European people, but I'm really just concentrating on the British people here, the British people are a branch from these original people of the Old Testament, going back to Brutus. But of course, there was a second migration around about 700 to 500 BC. Around about that time, the Israelites that were in Samaria, and Samaria was again, remember, that was part of the Phoenician Empire. The Israelites that were in Samaria were removed by the Assyrians to an area under the Black Sea and under the Caspian Sea. And the majority of the 10 tribes were there. And they would eventually start making their way into Europe after that. And we know that they started making their way into Europe because of other records that we find. In 1847, we discovered the Library of Nineveh, which was in Iraq. And looking at these records that we found in this Nineveh library, there were all the records of the spies that had been spying on these Israelites that were under the Black Sea and under the Caspian Sea. And these clay tablets refer to those Israelites as Qumri. And they get that word from King Omri, who is this Israelite king. So the Assyrians are referring to these Israelites as Qumri. And the Greek and the Roman geographers also called them the Cimmerians. Now, the Welsh people today are still called Qumri. And the Greeks and the Romans traced these Cimmerians as they made their way into Europe and into Western Europe to end up in Wales where they are today, basically. So the records of the Nineveh Library tell us that these Israelites were known as Qumri. But that isn't the only record we have of it. There's a huge inscription on Behistun Rock in Persia, which was put up there by Darius the Great. It's a huge great cliff face with this massive carving inscribed into it. And it's in three different languages. And it tells us that the Saka and the Qumri are exactly the same people, because you've got the same word in these three different languages. And the Saka is also the name for the Scythians or the Scythians. It's written S-C-Y-T-H-I-A-N-S. And Saka was the Babylonian or Persian word for the Scythians. And Qumri was the Assyrian word for the Scythians. So Saka itself, the word Saka, comes from the word Isaac. And in the Old Testament, it tells us, in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And these Saka would go on to become the Saxons eventually, and these other Germanic tribes. And we can trace them working their way in through the Israel Pass in the Caucasus, making their way by land and by boat into Russia, and then on into Europe. So we have clay tablets in Nineveh telling us that the Israelites are the Qumri. We have a huge inscription on Behistun Rock telling us that the Scythians, or the Saka, are also the Qumri and are also the Israelites. And we also have the Tell Armana letters. And the Tell El Armana letters were letters from Canaanite kings to the Pharaoh of Egypt, begging him for help. Now, the Canaanite kings were vassals of this Egyptian king. And they're saying, look, you've got to come and rescue us, because these Hebiru, these Saka, are coming to invade us. And these letters tell us that the Hebiru and the Saka were the same people. And the Egyptian Pharaoh refused to help. Now, it's not really surprising the Egyptian Pharaoh refused to help after what had happened when Moses left there and all the Egyptian firstborn got killed. So, I mean, that explains why the Egyptian Pharaoh refused to come and help these people. But what the real point of why I'm bringing that up now, though, is because in these Tell Armana letters, it tells you that the Hebiru and the Saka are the same people. So we've got all these various proofs that Israelites were known as Qumri, and they were also known as Scythians. And as they made their way into Europe, they would become known as the Celts, the Gauls, the Saxons, the Massageti, the Alans, the Goths. All these various Germanic tribes can be traced back to these same people in this area under the Caspian Sea and under the Black Sea. And this is why you get these legends of Asgard. And Odin supposedly came from Asgard and the Asia and this area. It was all back to this area in Asia Minor, which is where the Israelites were removed to. So Flavius Josephus, when he's writing, which is about the time of Christ, he writes that there are numerous Israelites that are beyond the Euphrates. And what he means by beyond the Euphrates is in Europe. In the Apocrypha, it tells us that these Israelites decided to move through the Euphrates and find a new land. And what Josephus says, he says, there are but two tribes in Asia and Europe subject to the Romans, while the 10 tribes are beyond the Euphrates till now, and are an immense multitude, and not to be estimated by numbers. So he's obviously talking about millions there. You know, these people have multiplied into their millions, which is, of course, what the prophecy was to Abraham, was that his descendants would be as the sand of the sea and the stars of the heavens. That's how many people his descendants would be. So Josephus here is talking about us in Northern and Western Europe. And this is who the Gospels and the Epistles are addressed to. Nobody else. Remember, the letter of James is addressed to the 12 tribes, the 12 lost tribes. Jesus says more than once that he came only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And don't think that because it says in the New Testament that these disciples and apostles should go to the Gentiles, that meant non-Jews. And the word Gentile does not mean non-Jew. It means nations. These are nations that were promised to Abraham. In God's promise to Abraham, in the Old Testament, they're actually referred to as Goyim. And of course, Gentile is just the Latinized version of the word Goy. And the word Goy just means nations. So when it's talking about going to the Gentiles in the New Testament, what it's talking about doing is going to the Gentiles descended from Abraham. The nations descended from Abraham. Nations just means Gentiles, and Gentiles just means nations. So depending on the context, which nations it particularly means. And because Christ said that he only came for the lost sheep of the house of Israel, then those nations that the disciples go out to can only be the nations descended from the house of Israel. Paul's letters confirm this, and he's constantly referring to this dispersion, the captivity, and all the prophecies about it all. He's constantly referring to or contrasting Esau, Edom, who the Lord has indignation against forever, and Jacob Israel and the descendants of Jacob Israel. He talks about the olive tree being grafted back in again. That's because he's talking about the same people. And don't forget, a large portion of these people actually moved away from Egypt before they were even given any law, so they never were under the law in the first place. Now, Abraham's faith was that his seed would become many nations, not that many nations would become Abraham's seed, which is what the church tries to tell us today. You really do have to watch these church translations, because they'll tell you that the Bible says something, but when you actually look at it for yourself, you realize that it says quite the opposite. Like when it's talking about sheep nations and goat nations. They will tell you that it's just talking about sheep and goats, meaning sheep and goats among one nation. But no, the New Testament calls the nations, some of the nations are sheep nations and some of them are goat nations. Not individuals among one nation, but different types of people. Christianity was intended only for us, was not intended for any of these other races. Certainly wasn't intended for the Jews. That's why Christ rejected the Jews. He dared the Jews to try to carry out his instructions, knowing full well that the Jews would never be able to. And he called them the sons of the devil, the Antichrist, a race of vipers. We fulfill all the prophecies of the Old Testament and all the promises, not the Jews. The Jews never have. The stones and the megaliths are a witness to this. The Israelites were told to erect these stones everywhere they went. They were told to put these megaliths up. And these customs and practices that our Druids had are exactly the same as the customs and practices of these patriarchs in the Old Testament. The genealogy of our King Brutus goes back to Zara and the genealogies in the Old Testament. And in fact, if you actually look at the family trees of all the monarchies in Europe, they all trace themselves back to the Old Testament and to the Bible. This is our ancestry in there. It's nothing to do with the Jews. The Jews are mongrels. They really are. They really don't want us to know this because it strips them entirely of their chosen status. And it removes the curse that most Christians believe will be upon them if they curse the Jews. It is us who are a blessing to those who bless us and us who are a curse to those who curse us. We would go on to send missionaries all over Europe from our Druidic colleges, converting the Goths, the Alans, the Gauls. Illuminated Celtic manuscripts are found in the Alps to this day that were written in our Druidic colleges. Our King Constantine would go on to become Roman Emperor and make Christianity the official religion of Rome. And Constantine was partially descended from Brutus. All these royal lines that we had in Britain before the Anglo-Saxons came over were all descended from Brutus. Arthur was descended from Brutus. Gildas in 500 AD called us the Israelites. James I of England claimed that he was the King of Israel. The Scottish Declaration of Independence in 1320 dates their beginning as a nation to when they first left Egypt at the time of Moses. Alfred the Great drew a distinction between the Jews and the tribe of Judah. And our heraldry can all be traced back to the emblems that were given to the 12 sons of Jacob Israel to identify them. And one of these emblems is actually a red hand. And you get the red hand of Ulster, which obviously has to go back to Zara and that red cord that's tied around his hand. And one of the most recent legends that we have about this red hand of Ulster, it says, oh, there was two kings having a race, and one of them cut his hand off and threw it past the finishing line. And that's the modern day legend. But of course, look at the similarity between that and the story of Zara. You've got two kings within the womb, and one puts his hand out first to win the race. And the guy that won the race was Zara. And yet, all most people know about is Phares in the Old Testament. And they learn about the Davidic kings, they learn about Solomon, and they think that's all there is to it. They don't realise that Zara was the one with the birthright, and Zara disappeared while they were all in captivity in Egypt. So you really do have to pay attention to what's going on outside the Bible to really find out what's really happening and where these promises that were given to Abraham were actually fulfilled. So I hope you can see that what Hayes in the Bard said, that I quoted right back at the beginning of this talk, what he said way back in the 6th century was entirely true. There never was a time that the British people were not Christian. We were following biblical doctrines while Moses was having problems with golden calves and miscegenating Midianites. And this is why Christianity took root in Europe. And this is why the Jews do all that they can to pretend that we had no civilization before the Romans came and that we were not a Christian nation until the Saxons invaded. And this is the reason why we accepted Christ as the Logos made flesh, because he was our Messiah, made from our race, and who our Druids were waiting for, exactly as foretold in the Bible, and as confirmed by our history books and our monuments.
You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.